listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another Catch Them Doing Something Good edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Every Monday from 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time to noon, my guests and I will bring you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. My co-host today is a very good friend of mine and, I think if given the choice, would still be in college today, Eric Erickson. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alan. It's nice to meet you. Actually, Alan and I have never met before.
Yeah, I was driving here, and the traffic was so bad that I was concerned that I wouldn't get here in time. So I saw this homeless guy on the road, and I figured, you know, this way I can go into the Diamond Lane if I pick this guy up. So it's going to be interesting.
And I had just finished selling my bag of oranges, so it worked out well for me too.
Yeah, well, actually, he made me buy the rest of them. That's why they sold out. So anyway, if you haven't noticed, Eric and I know each other pretty well, so we may go off on tangents, but don't worry. At least we'll enjoy it. Now, our guest will be calling in. Our guest today is Kathy Pewitt Miller. I'll go into a little bit of introduction for her. And actually, I'm looking at the board. Somebody's calling in, but that's not her. So anyway, Kathy is a nationally known expert in children's literacy and one of the few who concentrates on the roles of families as well as educators in children's learning to read. She has dedicated more than 13 years to spreading the message that reading and writing can be powerful, practical, and fun. A sought-after author, speaker, and consultant, Kathy is author of two new books. One is Anytime Reading Readiness for Parents and Before They Read for Educators. She is also author of the e-book Powerful Picture Books, 180 Ideas for Promoting Content, Learning, and a Guide to Using Picture Books to Spark a Love of Reading for Children Grades K to 12. And yes, some of today's picture books are complex enough to interest high school students. And I went on her website and I checked out some of that, and I could certainly agree. I think we have her calling in right now. Hi, this is Alan. You're on the air.
Hi, Alan. Kathy Miller.
Hi, Kathy. How are you? We just introduced you. Your timing is perfect.
Excellent.
So, were you able to hear what we said?
No.
Okay. Well, the part you missed was that on my way here, I picked up a homeless person to have him sit in on us, so we could have some very interesting things.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, but you know, the important part was I got to use the Diamond Lane and get through traffic. So, well, let me do this. First of all, for those that haven't, Kathy's been on the show before, and I didn't feel like we really got through everything. I think literacy is incredibly important throughout the world, not just here in the United States. And on top of that, she has one of the most beautiful voices, so just having her on the air was comforting to me.
Thank you so much. That's the Southern accent coming through, I think, Alan.
That's right. Well, let me jump right into some questions. And one of the questions that I've got, and a lot of people know, I'm not sure if you do, but I mean, as a room parent for my sons throughout grade school, I noticed that reading instruction in today's classroom looks quite different than it did in my day. There seems to have been so much scientific research conducted in the fields of education, psychology, physiology, and linguistics. How has it impacted how reading is taught to schools today, not only for the little ones, but for the older and more independent readers as well?
Well, let's talk about the young ones first.
You got it.
Virtually every public school and almost every private school in the country teaches reading through a technique or a method called phonics. Some of your listeners will be familiar with that because that's how they learn to read. Scientifically, we found that about 80% of children learn to read best by a phonics approach. And so that's why you see so much phonics in the early classrooms, is because they know that the majority of children are going to learn best that way. So that's something to celebrate, that we know that. We have to pay attention to that 20% that doesn't get it with phonics and make sure that we're doing some things for them. But in terms of the teachers teaching to the most children they can touch with any one method, phonics is it. Now, I had a child who did not learn phonics until after he had already learned to read, and so he was one of that 20%. And that's why parents are so important, because if your child happens to be learning to read by phonics, talk to your teacher, find out about it if you didn't learn about it, and if they are the 20% that doesn't learn very well with a phonics approach, then make sure that you are partnering with that teacher to say, okay, what else can we do? And then the emphasis, because of all this marvelous research, I'd say probably in the last 30 years, we've had, as we have had in many different fields, just an explosion of research. And the great thing is that that has given our classroom teachers a lot of information about scientifically what works. And so with our older children, we're really focusing on understanding what they read, because that's really why we read in the first place. And when they get so much focus on the decoding and the phonics in the early years, it's very important that they then turn that corner and start to pay attention to what all those words that they now know how to pronounce mean together and separately.
Kathy, my name's Eric, and I actually have known Alan for quite a while.
Oh, hey, Eric.
My question was that I've read a little bit of your bio, and such as is, how do you define literacy? When somebody to me brings up literacy, I initially think of just reading and speaking and stuff like that. Is yours a little bit more all-encompassing, or is that basically what you're pinpointing?
It is, and I really am relying on what experts in the field, the International Reading Association and several other organizations that support reading instruction, have identified literacy as. It really has five components these days, Eric. First of all, reading, which is what we always think of, but also writing. Those are real partners. Listening, communicating, how we use that language to communicate, whether it's in writing, can we do it effectively, or if it's just talking with someone. And finally, they've added viewing, because we take meaning out of pictures these days on the internet, when we're watching television, movies, DVDs, all those things. It's become such a pervasive way for us to gather information that they've added that fifth arm to the mix.
Now, Kathy, would you say that that's because we've become a more visual society? I mean, because of television, would that be the reason why they've added viewing and made it such an important component?
Yes, definitely it is. And also, we have more children these days, because they're growing up with all of that in their environment, we have more children that are visual learners than we did, say, 50 years ago.
And that was actually a follow-up question I was going to make is, I'm certainly not an expert, but I've always heard that certain people learn more visually and certain people learn more through other means. I've always thought that I was more of a visual learner, but do you think that it's being skewed more towards visual because of the other media and stuff we have?
I don't know that I would say it's being skewed. Our most expert teachers in the country know that children have different learning styles. Some children learn by doing, you know, very kinesthetic type of approach to things. Others learn best by hearing things. And then we have the visual learners. We have different types of learners. And so a lot of teachers have training in how to identify and adapt their instruction to meet those different learning styles. And that comes back to what we were talking about earlier about children learning how to read with phonics. Sometimes some of those children that have different than an auditory and visual combination will have trouble with that. And so we're learning to have other alternatives to help those children that we didn't have when everybody basically just was taught the same thing and you got it or you didn't.
Now, what about combining those? Because I know that as I was observing teachers, you know, being a room dad, I noticed that some of the teachers that seemed to work best, I thought, with the kids are ones that were combining. So they would give them something to do from a kinesthetic standpoint, and at the same time, you know, be writing it, letting them see it on the board, and then also saying it, so that they essentially were getting it all three ways.
Absolutely. That is so true, and that's really what you see your best teachers doing. Now, if you've got parents that are listening that don't really know, then it might be wonderful to just plan a day and go sit in the classroom and kind of watch what the instruction in reading is like for your child. It really will be an eye-opener for you.
I was just thinking of the television show Smarter Than a Fifth Grader, and I think for a lot of us sitting in the classroom, we may not get it anyway.
But at least it would give you a point to ask questions, especially if your child is a child that's going to need some assistance. Now, I will also say that, and we are going to get probably into this a little bit more later, but I don't want parents to be overly anxious about what thinking that they have to know everything that's going on in the classroom, because those teachers have gone to school 4, 5, 6, 7 years sometimes to gain the expertise they have. And there are lots of things that families can do that are a bit more family friendly that can add as much to their children's ability to read, write, listen, communicate, and view, and gather information that way as the scientific teaching can.
One of the things that I've been wondering about, too, is as far as the parents' literacy, and in some cases, their lack of confidence in their own literacy and then being able to interact with their children, either to bring them up to a level that they believe, or if the parents don't feel that they maybe have the education or the literacy to where they can supplement or even judge or anything like that. And I wondered if you had any, it's kind of a convoluted question, but if you had any insight into parents either having a lack of confidence in their literacy or knowing how to supplement the children's or the teachers.
Oh, yes. I have a couple of things right off the bat. First of all, I hope that we have some of those families listening to Alan's show, because sometimes I worry that we put so much emphasis on the academic side of reading that we forget that reading and writing, listening and communicating are really tools for life. And any parent, even if they don't read English or if they don't read very well, perhaps they're limited to maybe a 6th or 7th or 8th grade reading level, they think, well, there's not anything I can do with my child. But the best thing they can do is one of two things, or two things, actually. One, they can interact with their child, talk with their child, read with their child at the level that they can do that, and particularly showing them how they use reading and writing and listening and communicating in everyday life. That's going to be very meaningful to a child in terms of motivation. Why should I do all this stuff that they have me do in school anyway? So that's one thing. Also, regardless of where you are in your own reading, writing, listening, communicating, and viewing, you can tell a story. And let me tell you, children adore hearing stories about their own birth, about important times in their lives or their parents' lives. And you're using the oral language with which the written language is based when you're doing that. So even families that feel as though they have a limit on their education or their own literacy, there are things that they can do, and those things will make a difference, because children's oral language is what their ability to read is based on. If we just had to decode words we had never heard of and we had no mean understanding of the meaning for, decoding wouldn't be very valuable to us.
Yeah, but I think that's sort of an age-appropriate thing, too, because and I used to love to tell stories to the kids when they were little. Turns out now that they're teenagers, not that much interested in my stories.
Oh, that's true. So you need to change your stories.
That's right.
Because now they need to have you communicate about things that are important to them, sometimes decisions they're making, sometimes just talking about perhaps a novel that they're reading at school. there are all kinds of conversations you can have that don't have to turn your house into an academic hothouse, because nobody likes that, but that can stimulate those literacy skills.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And actually, I was just kind of teasing because I just had that conversation this morning with one of my sons, and I started to tell him a little bit about something, and he kind of rolled his eyes, and it was like, Dad, I got to get ready for school. Are we really going to do this now? So,
mm-hmm. Isn't part of it with teens, too, I think, just waiting for those right moments? I saw that so much with our son, who's 20 now, that when he was very young, he was just enamored with his dad and I. You know, he wanted to hang on our every word. And as he started to get to be his own person, that was not quite as common. But I say to parents out there and to Alan and Eric, with your children, having conversations with kids is like the network that will hold them to you and have them come back to you. And so even though you have to perhaps let them pick the times when they're open to having conversations, just tapping into having that happen on a regular basis is so, so important for them not to be a stranger when they're 16.
Well, and I think that that's really an important point. My son's 12 now, and he's getting really tired of listening to me because I tell way too many stories. But is also just being able to interact with their life and to find out what their views are, how their views are changing, and certainly not make it work, make it just the flow and everything like that. And sometimes we have ulterior motives, either to try and teach them something or to learn something from them, is just like you were saying with reading, is conversations should be fun and they should flow and such. And I think that that's a really important point as far as developing literacy too.
Yeah. Well, and I often say to family groups when I'm talking with them that it really is bigger than the book. Now, certainly reading and taking information from books is important, or from the internet or wherever we're seeing text, is important. But the whole reason we read anyway, hopefully, is to contribute, to learn, to be entertained, sometimes as an escape. I mean, there are lots of valid purposes for reading. I like to escape sometimes myself with reading. And every time a child learns about a new purpose for reading, then it makes more sense to them that it might be something they might want to do and they might want to continue to do in their own lives because it adds value. That's the message I think that we have to give families and children. We have to answer the question, why in the world should I want to do all this stuff that relates to reading anyway? And we have to give them a good answer.
Right. One of the things that I'm kind of circling back about, but you were speaking of literacy when they're younger children, I guess early elementary or whatever, is I wondered how that impacts as they go along, because so often I think of learning how to read and write and speak well at an early age is important, and then it just naturally progresses through there. But how does the say, kindergarten, first, second grade learning to become competent impact when they get into high school and then even college?
Oh boy, that's a great question. Let me back up a little bit and tell you what happens before. It used to be that we just thought, oh, nothing happens with reading until they start kindergarten or first grade, when they first receive formal instruction in it. When in fact, from the day they're born, the coos and the faces we make and the conversations we have with them and the chatting that we do all give them an oral language foundation. And that is really where it starts, because if they learn to decode a word and they don't know what that word is, or if they do know what that word is, then they get the meaning right away, and there they go off into the reading world. So I actually have written a new book for parents called Anytime Reading Readiness that is full of ideas for growing that oral language. And what scientists have found is that sometimes there can be as many as a 5,000-word difference in the vocabulary of children starting school. And that comes from children not being talked to, because that's how we get our language before we learn to read, is from hearing words from other people. And I just saw some recent research from a Dr. Dickinson out of, I believe he's at Vanderbilt now, who was talking about it's not so much how much you talk with your children as it is how many different words you use with them in the course of a conversation. And that's where we get those higher levels of vocabulary that are such an advantage when they start to school. And then once they're in school, if they continue to get support and continue to find it meaningful for them, then they're going to keep growing. And we see that even in by high school, that the amount of reading they were doing as a young child and how much they were read to as a young child, how much conversation they had with different words they had as a young child, can impact their ability to understand those higher level texts that they're having to face in high school. And there seems to be a direct connection between those early experiences and how well and how easily they will do in the upper grades and on into college. And I have to, I always like to take my professional hat off occasionally and put my mom hat on.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly our experience with our son was true to that model, because he learned to read at three, and I raise my hand and say, honestly, I did not do anything to teach him to read. I simply read to him a lot. I talked with him a lot. And three was the right age for him. Some children it's four. Some children it's five. Some children it's six. And all of that is normal. But Charlie, because he began reading so early and continued to get a strong environment, has always been a stronger reader than most of his peers in school. And that didn't become because Chuck and I drilled him to death. It came because we showed him a reason to read, and he gravitated to that because he found value in it.
Now, would that also be because of the way in which you spoke to him? And does this tie in at all between, there's the theory that it's not really good to talk baby talk, you know, to do the goo goo gaga type of stuff, and that at an early, as early as possible, you know, talk regular talk, you know, talk regular words, let them figure out how to break those down. Does that tie into that as well?
Absolutely, it does. And here's, again, it's bigger than literacy, because you think about it, our children are growing individuals. And I know that in the whirlwind of life, it is so easy to forget that part of your child and just get on what I call the correcting and directing channel. We've all been there as parents, and certainly our children need some of that. But if that's all we find ourselves doing with our children, then their literacy is being shortchanged in terms of the support they can get at home.
Well, let me throw in a listener question right now. We had a listener question that was emailed in that said, how do we determine the difference between our 8-year-old son not being able to read and not liking to read?
That's a great question. And here's the first thing I would suggest. There are actually several things to do there. 8-year-olds like power plays, don't they, Alan?
Oh, yes.
And so that certainly could be part of it, that he realizes he can have power over his parents and have get attention from them by pretending not to read. Now, the only way to really find that out is to go to his teacher and say, tell me what the assessments, the tests, the evaluations that you're doing in school are telling you. If they're telling, surely at 8, if they're giving signals that there is a developmental issue or a learning disability that's being flagged and somebody is saying we need to look at this more closely, and if it's not, then the parent needs to step in and say, don't you think we should look at this a little more closely at 8? Because most children by 8 are reading, certainly reading more than just single words on a page and that kind of thing. So that would be my suggestion to that parent. First of all, to recognize and maybe relax a little bit and not let that power struggle continue if it's just a power struggle. But if they talk to the school and they find out that their child is a master at memorizing things,
mm-hmm.
but is really not learning to read, then that's the point when you have to become an advocate for your child, because there are all kinds of resources in schools today to help identify. There's actually even something that has recently just gotten all kinds of press in the educational world called RTI, and that's a leveled approach to making sure that everybody gets a certain level of instruction. If they're not getting it at the first tier, then they need to have small group intervention to help them with whatever the issues are. If they're not getting at that level, they need individual attention, and that's called response to intervention, I think is what the RTI stands for. So there are all kinds of tools available for that parent, and she shouldn't feel like she's out there, he or she shouldn't feel like she's out there by herself, because there are lots of resources to help if their child, in fact, really does have a problem with reading.
Oh, thank you.
Kathy, this is Eric again. In response to that, is enticing your child to read, is how much editing should you do as far as their choices? And there's obviously a huge range of what's age appropriate and not. But do you, in your opinion, is it better to be more restrictive and to really say this is not appropriate? Or is it better off as if they find something that they're really interested in and it's not out of the realm of appropriate, but to let them go with what they want to do?
Absolutely. Choice should be on the top channel with families, because the kids have to read a lot of things that they may or may not like to read at school just because of the assignments made there. But again, it goes back to that connecting to motivation.
Right.
You know, what's going to get them to put out the effort to decode, you know, to figure out where those squiggles are on the page. And a lot of times, especially when you get to about fourth grade, children are starting to be less enamored, if you will, with mm-hmm. beginning reading. And if they're not able to read something that stimulates them and that gives them something worthwhile, then that's going to make them less likely to be a reader. And so that is just such an important issue with families, because there is so much non-choice in the classroom these days,
right,
and control over what you read and what you don't read, that the choice factor really has to come in at home.
All right. You know, we're going to take a break. And, Kathy, what I want you to do, if you can give everybody the website that they can maybe even follow along with some of the things that you're saying. Give us the website. If you have any additional questions that you want to ask right now, you can call in. The number's 323-203-0815. If you have questions and you want to email them in directly to Kathy, or you want to go to the website, Kathy, give us that website.
It's readingisforeveryone.org. And there's actually a contact button on the home page there. So if they have a question that they would like to send me directly that way, they can visit the website. Again, readingisforeveryone.org.
That's great. Now, and for everybody listening, if you want, you can go to that website. And while you're listening to the show, you can be perusing the website. It may stimulate some other questions. For those of you that are driving, please don't do that. And we'll be back in 1 minute. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. And I've still never figured out what that little noise is as we come back. Kathy, and actually Eric and I were just touching on a couple of things. One of the things I want to make sure that we do get is we talk about a little bit about the influence of politics on education. We know that there's been some changes. What can you tell us? I know that we did have what was called, you know, No Child Left Behind. We know that the federal government's trying to do some things. We know here in the state of California, they're claiming to do others. Bring us up to date on what you know on those influences.
That's great, because we do have to pay attention to the political climate. I mean, it's been part of what has happened that has changed the face of education. For your parents' information and for y'all's information as well, No Child Left Behind is still in place, and it is likely to be renewed with some modifications after we deal with the more pressing issues that seem to be on the plate of the administration right now. And so that's something to remember, that it's not going to absolutely change everything, because that framework of No Child Left Behind is going to still be there. Now, how much it will change, President Obama is talking about rewarding teachers almost like a merit reward system for quality teaching. And so that's something that's getting more of a front plate approach than it was under the previous administrations. We are seeing a lot of states, including my own home state of Alabama, put a lot of effort into professional development, which is what their tag is for helping teachers in continuing education. That's a key, because one of the issues before No Child Left Behind was that we had so many different levels of teaching going on in the country, and nobody really guiding that toward research. People just kind of were in their own classroom doing their own thing, and sometimes that was absolutely marvelous, other times it wasn't so good. So we can actually celebrate that part, but we still want to make sure that teachers are not just being painted in a corner and being told everything they need to do in their classroom, because they're professionals. They have a wealth of knowledge from the study they've done on, as we talk specifically about reading and writing, on those subjects. And so they really need some ability to control what's happening in their classroom. One of the great things that's happening is they're starting to look at developing some very basic national standards, because right now every state sets their own standards. They write their own test or buy a test that fits those standards. So, of course, most states look like they're doing a great job. But when we look at the independent study that's going on across 50 states, we don't see as rosy a picture.
Which, Kathy, I think that would be great. And one of the things, and actually this is probably more of a statement than an actual question, but is I feel very personally about No Child Left Behind. When my son was going into kindergarten, our school in our district, we live in a district that has exceptional schools, but our home school was actually far below standard. It had been substandard for over 3 years, which was the criteria for No Child Left Behind. And I tried to get him moved to a different school. And at that point, which was now 6 or 7 years ago, is California was in so much financial problem that they were blatantly ignoring No Child Left Behind. And we put him in private school, and now he's actually in a charter school. I don't know how California is actually set up now, and I know we're having a lot of financial problems here, but I know at that point that California had a unspoken disregard for No Child Left Behind because financially they couldn't comply. I don't know if that's the same across the country, and I don't even know if you want to address that, but like I said, is I kind of have a very personal response to No Child Left Behind.
Well, and I can mention one thing, and that is that the negative part, in my opinion, of No Child Left Behind has been that the results on the test that were used to evaluate where children are in reading was tied then to how much federal funding that state would get. And so, of course, that's going to cause most people to want the test scores to look really good and to do some teaching to the test, if you will,
right,
in order to get a hold of those federal dollars. And so I think that's been an unintended consequence, that there's been in some places an overemphasis on assessment. I was in a school 2 years ago as part of a national study with some first graders in four different states, and one of the things that I saw was that the children were so into taking the test that they could regurgitate what they needed immediately for the test, but when you talk to them about understanding what they were reading, they weren't on that channel.
Right.
And so that said to me, perhaps we were overemphasizing, especially with our most needy students, and needy in terms of struggling, not economic. We seem to have hopefully started to move toward more of a, if we do the national standard, then everybody will be on the same page and we won't have this competition for funding between states.
Well, Kathy, now, Kathy, let me ask about that, the national thing, because one of my concerns, and I guess the question would be, how can we keep them from setting up a national standard that literally brings down everything to a level that everybody can reach versus trying to bring everybody up? And that's one of the concerns that I have is that the concept of, okay, well, we're going to standardize everything and we're going to make everything the same. And even a little bit of my involvement with some of the schools has been not that they want to raise everybody up, but that they want to, like with sports, okay, well, we're not going to keep score now because we think it's hurting their feelings if they're on the losing side, you know, or, you know, some people aren't excelling as well because they're not getting it, so we're going to bring the standard down. That's my concern, is we don't want to get into a situation of a dumbing down to make everybody happy or to make everybody mediocre so that it somehow doesn't hurt anybody's feelings. I think what made this country strong was the fact that we set high standards and we went for it, and we had people that were willing to work for it. And what can we do as the citizens to make sure that the national standards are things that are set up to excel?
The first thing I think we can do is, and I've actually got a couple of suggestions, and the first one is political. Certainly with all the approach to attention to health care and several other really important issues, education can take a back seat.
Good point.
If you have concerns, if the audience has concerns, they need to talk to their local representative. They need to find out who is serving on the education committees and send an email to them and voice what they're feeling, because we do live in a country where that still works. Mm-hmm. And so that's the one thing I would say on the political side. The other thing is, if you are able at all, parent involvement is taking a higher position in terms of policy in most schools, because if the school is a Title I school with the federal funding from Title I, they're required to spend a certain amount of their money on parent involvement. Now, that's an open door for families not to get in and try to overrun the school or ignore the expertise that may be there, but to have their voice heard and have a dialogue happening between home and school. And so I think that's a very important issue, to make sure that we keep the standards. And the other side of that is something that absolutely everybody, whether they're political or not, can do, and that is to talk with your children, what we were talking about earlier, talk with your children on a regular basis, use lots of different language with them, learn together if that's a weak area for you. Having books in your home and setting an environment, actually, my book, Anytime Reading Readiness, has a little checklist in it of how you can set up a home that is reader-friendly without being some kind of artificial academic environment. And so I think that that's a call for us, because when we think back to when this country was first formed, we didn't have a lot of federal leadership in education, but families were very much on the channel of, this is something that I have a part in. And one of the scary things about getting so scientific in how we teach the mechanics, if I can call it that, of reading, is that many parents have gotten the mistaken idea that they don't have a role anymore, when in fact their role is more important than ever if we're going to have people that rise to what the requirements will be this century and beyond in terms of literacy. Because you think about the literacy demands on young people today compared to what it was 30 or 40 years ago, it's a whole nother planet in terms of just the raw information that's coming out at us. You think about the reading a mortgage application, for instance, is a good example, because it has become such a complex document that many people sign it without even knowing what it says, because they don't have the understanding to figure out what all of that says.
Yeah,
I think that's just right down, you know, in everyday neighborhoods. That kind of thing is happening. And
right.
So we have to make education and reading a priority with our children, not just in the classroom with excellent schools, but also by realizing that every family has a role with their child that will make the difference.
Right, but what you're saying is the parents have a role, but it's not the same as the teacher, right? So tell us more about
that.
They
don't have to know all those. Actually, I did something not too long ago. I have a blog called Parents and Kids Reading Together .blogspot.com. If you just Google Parents and Kids Reading Together, you'll find it. And I posted a list of terms that the educators use that may be a foreign language to parents, just to help them understand some of those terms so they can ask some intelligent questions during parent-teacher conferences or open houses or any other time that they have to interact with the teacher. But also to recognize that it is very much, reading is not an academic exercise. Certainly we use it as a tool in the academic environment to learn, but it is not exclusively something to be used in school. So
sure.
We have to get off that channel of thinking of reading as something academic purely. You know, reading is a tool for life. And that's where parents can be so powerful in helping children understand that very, very important message.
And that I couldn't agree with you more as far as the family's importance, and then but also the teacher having the teacher seems like that they're kind of like the president and that the parents should be the CEO, where they should oversee everything, but the teacher should implement it. But my question was going to be is, in your book, can you tell us a little bit, just real briefly, how to make your house reading friendly?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm going to start not talking about print because that's the first thing we always think about. And actually, this book, Anytime Reading Readiness, and also a partner book written for teachers called Before They Read, which is for teachers of 3 to 6-year-olds, focuses on three big ideas. One is oral language development. That simply means being able to use the language well in speech, and that comes from practice and exposure. So that's the very first thing, and everyone can talk with their child. Almost everyone can talk with their child. And so that's something that every parent can take ownership of right away. And I like to start with that one because it's not that academic side. And just having conversations about the importance of education is something that even parents who aren't educated can do. That's the very first thing. The second thing that I cover in both of those books is positive experiences with print. And that's print in your world, like being able to read street signs so you know where you're going when you're trying to find a place you've never been to before, to reading books, e-books. The internet is mostly still text. So it's all around us. And if we're not using it as a tool, then we are shortchanging ourselves in what we could be accomplishing for ourselves and our families and for other people. So those are the first two things. And the last one is just playing with the sounds of the language. I'll give you a good example of that. When I was a child of the 50s, in the 50s, every commercial was a jingle, a rhyming jingle. And my mother read nursery rhymes to me. Now, most children growing up today have neither of those things in their experience. And yet, when they get to school, we're trying to get them to listen to the parts and sounds within words. So they don't have that foundation that we had. So that means that we need to be playing word games with children. And that isn't, again, mean anything academic. It can mean driving down the street and finding everything that starts with the letter A, or finding an A on the billboard that you're passing, or things like that. Just making it a fun family experience. And those kind of activities will build the skills that they need that will then tap into that academic instruction that they get in the classroom.
Well, I think the rhyming is a great point, because what we're competing with is we're competing with rap. I mean, you know.
There you go. Well, you know, and see, that is rhyming, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And
there
and
may be some content to that you may not want your children to listen to, but
exactly.
That's something that's kind of hip, that's rhyming.
Right.
And rhyming is the doorway to an awareness of how the sounds in our language work. That's the first, usually the first sense that children get when they're thinking about a part of the word for its sound instead of the whole word for meaning, which is what we teach children up until about 2 or 3. You know, they're just learning vocabulary.
Okay. Now, I want to make sure that we cover everything, as we had a few more questions that I know came in.
Sure.
I know that there was a listener question, but let's talk a little bit more about, you know, the difficulties with reading. You know, in other words, the child who's struggling or is pretending to struggle. I mean, I think that's an issue that a lot of us are dealing with our children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are some more of the things that we can do as parents? And I know you're talking about you make it more fun. Mm-hmm. You know, we're struggling with the thing about, you know, what type of reward, you know, and I've tried different things where there's a reward for, you know, an amount of money for amount of pages, or, you know, if you complete this book and write this. I mean, you know, at what point are we maybe going too far on that?
Okay. Well, now, one thing I think we need to recognize is that there's a whole lot more competition for reading than there used to be. When I was growing up in rural North Carolina, there wasn't too much to do besides read. But our children don't have that problem anymore.
Yeah, plenty of stimulation.
And, I'm sorry?
I said you're right. There's plenty of stimulation out there.
Absolutely. So carving out a little time for them to read is a good thing. Why not read, not necessarily together if your child's older, but all at the same time? Maybe once a week to start with. Say, okay, for a half an hour, everybody's going to shut down, get off the iPods and the Blackberries and everything else, and just wind down and read a little bit. Now, the good thing that that does, not only for children, but for adults, is it de-stresses you. You slow down to a different pace when you're reading text than you do when you're surfing the net or hooked into all our technology and electronics and things like that. Now, at the same time, we need to recognize that our children's use of technology still, in many instances, is tied to text, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So we need to make sure that we're not ignoring that that is part of their literacy as well. And so we're not criticizing that as something useless when, in fact, I've even heard of some teachers using blogs and wikis and even text messages as a tool to help kids communicate about books that they're reading. And I thought, what a great idea to tap into the technology that the kids are already enamored with and show them that, yes, reading and writing are even tools for these things. So that's one thing that I think is very important, is for us to find that balance between carving out a little time.
Well,
and as far as rewards is concerned, that can work short term, but it won't work long term. Some of you may be familiar with Accelerate Reader in your child's school. That program was originally designed to be a temporary external motivation, just to expose kids to reading, knowing that if they read enough, they would find things they were interested in, it would make them read more, and that just feeds itself. What it has become in many places is a reward system that may work initially, but then loses its polish, and then it's not effective anymore. And I tend to think that external rewards usually go that way. They might work temporarily, but in the long term, they're not going to make your child a reader.
Well, Kathy,
what is going to make your child a reader is what is interesting to them.
And, Kathy, I appreciate that. Unfortunately, I glanced over, and we are out of time. You've done this to me again. There is so much information.
We have to do it on a regular basis.
That's right.
Alan.
Yeah, we're going to have to do this every 6 months or so just to get caught up. So, again, thank you very much. Now, real quickly, it's www.parentsandkidsreadingtogether.blogspot.com. Kathy, thank you so much. And we will look forward to talking to you again. Take care.
Okay, Alan. Thank you. And thanks to everyone who listened in.
You got it. Bye now. Eric, thank you. I appreciate you being here. time went by really fast. I'll give you the ride back to where I picked you up on the freeway.
I got to stop and pick up some more oranges.
There we go. Everybody, thank you. Have a great week. We are out of here.
To Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza. Only on LA Talk Radio.